I wanted to start with a painfully obvious remark, namely that the category that we're talking about today is a very large and very diverse one. Obviously, because on the one hand, this term experiment, as we know from science studies, is applied to quite distinct kinds of operations, but also because, on the other hand, agriculture as a community or an activity is itself very diverse in terms of occupational groups and interest groups and so forth. So given that diversity, I thought it might be useful to start off with just mapping the terrain of agricultural experiment a little bit to give us a start at orienting ourselves toward this beast. And I want to refer to two features of agricultural experiment in order to do this. The first one is to ask the question, what do we actually mean by agricultural experiment? And this can mean a number of things. This is going to be a quick and dirty taxonomy. Obviously, collectively, we could almost certainly come up with additional interesting forms of agricultural experiment. But as a start, consider this. To begin with, it refers, in some cases, to hypothesis testing of the conventional kind, that is in the agricultural sciences. It means, equally familiar to us, is what you might call product testing, in which fertilizers or seeds or soils or varieties are tested for their properties, the kind of thing that was going on in Northampton, Hampstead, and at the very earliest experiment stations in the 19th century. It also entails testing processes, as it were, namely cultivation practices, again, fertilization, plant spacing, layout of a field, again, the kinds of things that were going on at Lothampton. Those are all fairly obvious, but it seems to me there is at least one additional category of experiment that we ought not to forget, and that's what you might call cut and try. As Paul Richards pointed out in a classic book in the mid-1980s, small farmers, family farmers, peasant farmers, completely illiterate peasant farmers also experiment in the sense that they conduct their own comparative studies on their own farms and evaluate how different crops or different varieties fare in different parts of their farm on different soils and in different, slightly different climatic contexts. Okay, in scale and in its systematicity, it doesn't compare to what goes on at an experiment station, but it is undertaken nonetheless as a form of inquiry, and it's important, very important, to bear in mind that these peasant experiments, if you will, in inverted commas, have been enormously powerful. And that is conceded fairly often by agricultural experiments, scientists themselves, who will say, you know, we went into such and such an area to advise the local small farmers on new planting techniques, and we learned pretty fast that they know more than we do about the properties of different varieties, of different crops, of the climatic differences from one part of the valley to another, and soil variations and so forth. The average, very unsophisticated farmers know a hell of a lot about the kinds of things that systematic testing on experiment stations has learned. And the other kind of question to map the terrain that we might ask is, where is agricultural experiment conducted, and by implication, who carries it out? And the point here that I would emphasize is that this sort of activity is not just carried out on experiment stations or in agribusiness firms. It was also carried out in the 19th century, as some of you undoubtedly know, by agricultural societies. And as well as in the 19th century and earlier on farms, both on large estates by farmers like Robert Bakewell, initially a farmer, later to become known as an animal But not only on, and this is also the case for early plant breeding in continental Europe and in Britain as well in the 19th century. The initial experimenters, if you will, the initial breeders were farmers who just turned their hand to this, usually estate owners who turned their hand to this, and then eventually developed this sidelight into a commercial proposition. And then finally, as I've already suggested, these farms don't have to be large estates of thousands of acres. They can be tiny farms of 3 or 4 acres. So experiment is not just the preserve of the exports. Okay, given the diversity of this category, agricultural experiments, I thought what I would do was not to discuss the papers individually, but to try and tease out a couple of general themes which are common to several of the papers, and themes which look to me as though, well, hopefully they will be useful for the discussion, themes that look to me as interesting for further inquiry. And the first of these themes is that agricultural experiment is the locus of conflict, as became obvious most recently in Angela Cassidy's paper. The mythology of scientific method, as everybody in this room knows, is that, in a sense, experiment should resolve conflict. It should end debate. But in fact, as we know, it very often ends up stirring up conflict and aggravating it. Either because, for a variety of reasons, partly because the results are often ambiguous, as in the badger trials, or because they're morally objectionable, which we saw not only in Angela's paper, but I think, if I read Andrew Gardner's paper correctly, that experimental demonstrations of animal welfare are themselves contestable. The disputes or conflict may also arise over the question of who actually has control over agricultural experiments. And one sees such disputes in Judith's paper, I think, where the question is, are experiments best controlled and designed by experts, by agricultural scientists, or by farmers? Even if we concede the point, which we may well not, that agricultural experiments should be controlled by agricultural experts, you still are left with the question, which again emerges from Judith's paper, should those experts be agricultural scientists or statisticians? What is the proper locus of control? Because the locus of control is going to dictate how the experiment is designed. And the whole question of design of experiments is, well, it came across in Angela's paper too, has been a very contentious issue. In the Green Revolution, for example, as many of you may appreciate, a recurring criticism of the claims made for high-yielding varieties in the Green Revolution was that the results are largely inapplicable because varieties perform much better under the experiment station conditions in which they were characterized than they do on actual farms. Critique essentially that they have been misdesigned and that their testing ought to be off the station and on the farm. Secondly, the question that that emerges in some of these papers and that we might want to address further is the whole question of utility of agricultural experiments. I mean, nominally, agricultural experiments presumably were supposed to be useful. But as soon as you say that, you have to ask, well, useful for whom? This issue came up, I think, in Paul Smith's paper, for example, where there seems to be, if I understood it, the paper rightly, a problematic relationship between the horticultural growers on the one hand and the experts in the LTRS, who felt obliged, as I recall, to move their research in a fundamental direction. To that extent displeasing the growers. It also was an issue that came up in Miguel's paper where he traced this shift in the orientation of research, animal breeding research at Edinburgh, away from the improvement of animals and animal productivity toward human health, a shift away from, as it were, farming with an F to farming with a PH that was benefited the pharmaceutical industry, presumably a great deal more than it did the British farming. And why should there be this shifts over time in the clientele for research? Obviously, this relationship between public sector agricultural researchers and their intended clientele is a variable one over time and space. It seems to be manipulable. It seems to be responsive to pressure. And as soon as we say that, then it raises a whole series of new research questions about the lobbying that goes on to push public sector research agendas in some directions and away from others. And in Paul Smith's paper, for example, he talked about the pressures on the LTRS agenda coming from the state, but also coming from the food industry. Miguel's paper, he referred to pressure on the Edinburgh Institutes coming from the ARC from the mid-1970s, but that also raises the question, where is ARC policy coming from? To what extent is it the plaything of government policy? And where does all of this end in the political realm? And then finally and thirdly, one of the themes that occurs most clearly in Dominic Barry's paper is that obviously agricultural experiments are intended to persuade, are intended to bring people, doubters, critics on board, or persuade publics to support a particular agricultural policy, as in the Badger case. And I think Dominic's use of, although this issue of persuasion is only discussed specifically in his paper, it seems to me that it is a shared concern for everyone who's interested, at one level or another, everyone who's interested in agricultural experiment. I think his use of Latour is really quite productive, although I think it was also a point that emerged in the question and answer session after the paper and was conceded by Dominic, is that one oughtn't to push any metaphor too far, as it were. The theorists of metaphor and analogy, Mary Hesse, Max Black and co., have often said, referred to the notion of disanalogy and neutral analogy, that even the most powerful, heuristically powerful analogies in the history of science always display invariably also areas of disanalogy. And for my part, I didn't find the Latourian analogy particularly illuminating when it came to understanding farmers' behavior, but I did find it very interesting when applied to plant breeders, especially in interpreting the relationship between Mendelians and plant breeders. For example, one can see from Dominic's paper that both Mendelians for their part and Pasteurians for their part are theorists or interpreters who are trying to bring on board through a process of enrollment practitioners of their respective kinds. We can see that plant breeders, on the other hand, like the hygienists, we can see as more as visionaries or reformers who have a concept of how they want to change the domains of health or the agricultural economy. And finally, the one can see, I think it makes sense to see Mendelians like the Pasteurians as significantly, heavily dependent upon